a better way. You don't have to be another face in the crowd. Well, hi folks, this is Jack Spirko with the Survival Podcast. Welcome to an episode of Friday Flashbacks. After 15 years and hundreds of interview shows, we decided to run them as flashbacks every Friday. Beginning with the oldest of them and going forward, there's a tremendous library of wisdom in all the great interviews we've done over the years. So sit back and enjoy. Whether this is your first time or even your second time around with today's episode, I'm sure you will enjoy it and learn a lot from it. And remember, you can help support the Survival Podcast and the work we do just by becoming a member of the Survival Podcast Members Support Brigade. If you do that, you'll get access to over 70 awesome discount codes on products and services you likely already use. Things like seeds, cannabis products, food storage items, custom roasted coffee, and even cool stuff like ammo and moonshine stills and more. So support the show, get all your money back and more. Just go to thesurvivalpodcast.com and click on members to learn more and sign up. Now let's get into today's Friday Flashback. And today we are flashing back to 6/16/11. This was originally episode 686. Rob Miles on bat conservation and habitat management. Again, recorded all the way back June 16th, 2011. And this is one of those episodes as I've started doing this flashbacks. It's like a happy surprise. Oh yeah, I remember that conversation, sort of. It's gotten to the point now, you know, in the very beginning of doing the show, I used to listen to every episode I recorded. For those that don't know, I started the show in my car. I would record it in the morning, get to my office, post it, do my whole day. And then when I would drive home, I would listen to it. I did that the way you know, when you play football, you watch tapes of yourself, not so you can see what you did good, but so you can see what you screwed up. And, you know, over the years, you get pretty good at it. So I don't do that much anymore, sit and listen to myself talk. But these flashbacks, I've been listening to them. Because, you know, you're going back here more than a decade, right? This is 13 years ago. I mean, I forgot how cool some of these conversations were. And I'm thinking for a lot of you guys, it may be the case that, you know, you're experiencing these, like I said during the canned intro and outro for these shows, for the first time. But for many of you, like, you may have been around back when this came out and forgot all about some of the cool stuff we talked about. And it's making me more and more happy that I eventually decided to basically bag off on Fridays and do these, because there really is an incredible, and I mean an incredible base of knowledge in all the interviews that we've done over the years. This interview, as I mentioned during last week's flashback, took place during the time that I was up in Arkansas. There's been a lot of life that's gone on in 16 years of doing this show, and this one just kind of hit me like, wow. And I'm like excited to do this. Like, I mean, what else is there that I've totally forgotten that we did in the past? And I think more and more of these will come up. Real quick, before I drop you off into this old episode, just remind you about tspaz.com, where you can help us out whenever you shop online. And our items of the day this week, there were three really great ones. And I think the sales, and you know, I'm recording this Thursday, so it could not be true by Friday. I think the sales involved are still going on, and inventory's still there. We had the TP-Link Deco AXE500 Tri-Band 6E Mesh System. I'll just say, check that out if you're in any way unhappy with your home network. Because it's a buy once, cry once. It's not the cheapest thing you can do for a home network, but it's awesome. And the ones that are on sale this week are the renewed ones for about $200 versus over $300. So it's about $100 savings on probably the best system for the most people there is. For if you have a large house you want to have, or you want to have better signal in your garage or your shop or something, these are just awesome. The Victorinox 6-inch semi-stiff boning knife, I mean, the number one knife used by professional meat cutters in the country. I can confidently tell you that. On sale this week for $23 freaking bucks. Get two of them. And then the end grain bamboo cutting board that I know is going to disappear sooner or later, and I'm not happy about it. It keeps disappearing and coming back and disappearing and coming back. And ever since that started, it's also been on sale. And until this has started, it's never been on sale. It's always been about $25 more. All of these are great ways to improve your life at home. With that, let's slide on back to 2011 and hear about bats and bat conservation and all the wonderful things that bats actually do for us as far as controlling insects if we would just start taking care of them again. And when I saw this one, it also reminded me, I'll just share this real quick with you. I don't have a lot of great memories growing up. I don't. My family life sucked, and that's just the truth. It's not a pity party. It just is. But I had some pretty cool grandparents and some pretty cool great uncles. And my great uncle Pete, he lived one house up from where my grandparents on my dad's side lived. He was my grandmother's brother from that side of the house. Also, Ukrainian heritage type guy. And he was an interesting guy. And the one thing about him that I will always remember him fondly for, he was the kind of guy that when I was a kid, I'm talking 11, 12, 13-year-old kid, you know, before we even moved there, when I'd be up there for the summer and whatnot, I would just walk up the street, knock on the door. And he never didn't have time for a kid. That was one of the things that was really awesome about him. I think about now, like if I were in his position and I had a great nephew and he just randomly walked up to the door, I don't know if I would follow great Uncle Pete's example. Right now, I don't know that I could because I have a job. You know, he's retired, but he always had time for me. And one of the things we really used to like to do, he was in all kinds of things. He was a hunter and a fisherman. He was the guy I've talked about before. He raised pigeons. And in the evenings, we would sit out in his backyard. He had about 3 acres, beautiful, beautiful piece of property. And we would watch the bats fly around. And I remember how many bats there were. And I remember, I don't know if I was 9 or 10. It was one of the summers I was up there when we were still living in Florida. And he said, look at the bats. And I realized something at that point in my young life. I'd seen those bats my whole life. I never really knew they were bats. I always just assumed they were birds. I didn't pay enough attention. You're 9, 10-year-old. You don't pay attention to stuff like that. Oh, my God, they're bats. And they're going to come get you. No, they're not going to come get you. Relax. And we would sit out there and watch the bats together. And it was several years later, and he was still around when this was going on. I used to fish this pond up the street from there, and I ended up one day, I tied some flies that were basically little white puffballs, and I used to fly fish for carp, and people would come out there and feed them bread, so a little white puffball, and I'm up there, and I'm working a fly rod, and a freaking bat grabs the fly, which is really a puffball, out of the air, and I ended up catching a bat on a fly rod, and I had some flashbacks like this, just when I saw this episode come up today. So let's go ahead now and flash on back to 2011 and hear all about bats from Rob Miles, who ended up being, I didn't even realize how big a deal it was to get him on the show. This dude's been on like late night TV shows and stuff like that. Really well known dude. So here we go. All right, folks, and as I said during the introduction segment, we are fortunate to have with us today Rob Myas of the Organization for Bat Conservation that's going to talk to us about making bats, make a bat-friendly environment around your home and how to keep bats where they belong and out of where they don't belong. So, hey, Rob, thanks for joining us today on the Survival Podcast.
Yeah, I'm glad to be here. Thanks.
Hey, you know, I had a listener of mine, I don't remember exactly who it was that I think tied us together, but he's actually been on my case for a long time. Hey, you gotta get this guy on the show. You know, I know it's a little bit different of a topic. I actually think it's a great synergy, having you on the show because even though we talk about emergency preparedness and long-term planning for disaster, we also talk a lot about self-sufficiency. We talk about a lot about gardening and sustainability and permaculture, sustainable agriculture. And I think bats fill a really interesting, niche in the environment. And unfortunately, they've kind of taken it on the chin with some of the things done with pesticides over the years and misunderstanding by people. But for the folks that are maybe like, you know, what's this, bats, you know, why would you want bats around your property anyway? Why would you want to attract them?
Yeah, and I think you're totally right about, you know, people caring about bats, and they should. And the biggest misconception about bats is that they're not worth anything. You know, people have heard that bats might be blind, or that they might get stuck in their hair or drink their blood. And those are myths. Bats are not blind. Bats don't go into people's hair. You know, they don't attack people. And vampire bats do exist, but they don't live in the United States. They live in Central and South America, and they usually go up to cows. But the biggest myth is that people just have no idea why bats are around. And so bats are the primary predators of nighttime insects. They eat more insects than things like purple martins or dragonflies or, you know, other kinds of, even spiders and things like that. One bat could eat 2,000 to 6,000 insects every single night. They eat moths, gnats, flies, mosquitoes, beetles, just about anything that flies at night. And the insects that they eat the most are moths and beetles, and those are huge crop pests and forest pests as well.
Absolutely. And I've noticed you guys are big on the whole concept of a bat house. And I mean, I think a lot of people are probably like, you know, bats pretty much in nature look after themselves. So why would a homeowner in suburbia or a rancher or a farmer or a small scale agriculture producer want to put up housing for bats? Can't they just kind of make their own way?
Yeah, I think most people put up bat houses for three different reasons. One is because they like bats and they want to see bats. It's, you know, kind of like putting up a birdhouse or a bird feeder. The other reason is that bats eat so many insects, and they actually fly pretty close to around where they live, so near their roost. So let's say you don't see many bats flying around, you only see one or two bats. Well, they don't fly in flocks. So when they forage only a couple of bats together. The only time you'd see lots of bats is if the roost is nearby. So a lot of people will want to put up a bat house to bring a colony in closer. So I was just on the phone just minutes ago with one of our members just outside of Indianapolis that lives right next to a farm, and he's got about 1,200 bats in six of his bat houses. So between all six bat houses, he's got about 1,200 bats. Couple different species, but he has very few insects around, and the neighbors also absolutely love it, and obviously the farmer absolutely loves it as well. And then the third reason to put up a bat house would be because sometimes bats get in people's houses. So they might get behind their shutters or inside their attic, and you need to provide them an alternative so they live outside of your house.
Yeah, I think that, like, I recently experienced something similar to this. They weren't in the house, but we were getting ready to move, and I had these umbrellas, like the big ones that you put up, like over a deck to create shade, and both of them were down. And when we opened both of them to clean them out before we packed them up, we actually donated them instead of bringing them up to our new place, both of them had a couple bats living inside the umbrella. And to me, that means that, you know, one, they didn't have enough habitat that was suitable for them, so they were using the next best thing. I'm sure there are plenty of places a bat would prefer to be other than in a canvas umbrella, but I guess in my area with the, you know, those particular bats, that was the best they could do. So if I had given them a place that would have been more suitable to them, they probably would have been happy to use it.
Yeah, that's right. And I do have I've talked to a lot of people that have occasionally gotten them inside an umbrella like that. So that's really interesting. Or even sails, too, on a sailboat. But especially in barns, you know, in attics, behind shutters, log cabins, they're really notorious to have bats living inside them. So, yeah, just providing an alternative is a really great way. If people have bats living in their attic or something, the best thing to do is to find out exactly where they're coming and going. So what I do is I watch the house. So let's say sunsets at 9 o'clock p.m. I'll watch the house from 9 o'clock till 9:30. And if there's bats inside, they're going to be flying out if it's warm, like let's say above 50 degrees Fahrenheit, or and especially if there's insects flying. I mean, these bats are going to be hungry. So you'll see the bats fly out, and then you can identify the spot and then put on some type of one-way funnel or flap that allows the bats to be able to exit, but then they can't get back in. And then hopefully they'll move right over into the bat house.
Very, very cool. And what would you say to people that have, you know, you talked about myths, and I think one of the big myths out there is that, you know, and it's not really a myth, it's just out of context, and that's that bats carry rabies. And a rat can carry rabies, a dog can carry rabies, a possum can carry rabies, any mammal can carry rabies. But I think people have this tendency to believe that bats have a higher incidence of rabies than any other mammal out there. Is that the case, or is it just something that's kind of an old wives' tale or a scare tactic or what?
I think rabies is actually really interesting. You know, I've been studying bats for almost 20 years, and obviously rabies is one of the, you know, key topics that we're always discussing. Rabies, you know, is a virus that usually kills the animal. It comes through either a bite and the saliva going directly into your bloodstream, or nervous tissue from an animal going into your bloodstream. So, I mean, most people don't come in contact with that. So, it's usually a bite. So, you know, it's not actually that easy to get rabies. You have to get bitten by a wild animal that has rabies, and then you don't wash your hands, you know, you don't go to the doctors, and so it's rare. In the United States, less than usually one or two people die of rabies in the United States every year. Worldwide, 60,000 people die of rabies. And Jack, do you know the number one animal that transfers rabies to humans?
I would guess it would be dogs.
That's right. Yep. Almost entirely.
I almost hate saying it, but that just, it would, because you have to get bit, and I've been around plenty of bats, and I've never been bit by a bat.
Right, yeah. Well, and also in other countries, you know, especially in third world countries, people just, it's not part of the culture, but also especially it's not cost effective to get your dogs and cats vaccinated. So, you know, you go to Mexico for vacation, and boy, you know, don't pet any stray dogs or cats, man, because they're probably not vaccinated. So,
and they're more likely to bite because they're in close proximity with humans, and they don't have fear of humans. Where, I mean, like I said, I think about the only way I know to get a bat to bite you, and there are vampire bats that will feed on blood of mammals, but again, they're not here. And, you know, I was in Panama for 2 years, and they're there, and we never had a problem with them coming after us. But other than that, I just don't see you getting bit by a bat unless you, you know, grab it or hold on to it in some way.
Yeah. And that's absolutely right. Now, where people, I think, sometimes misunderstand the bats and rabies is, one is that bats aren't carriers of rabies. So if they get the disease and the symptoms, they don't recover from that. So they don't have the disease, pass it on, and continue to live. If they get the symptoms, they die from it.
So to put an analogy, it's not like a mosquito transmitting, malaria, where the mosquito is not affected by the malaria, and it's a vector. It doesn't work that way. If the bat gets rabies, the bat too gets sick and usually succumbs to the illness. So it's a self-limiting thing.
Right. So it's not like all bats have rabies because they'd all be dead. You know, they would just be dropping, you know, all over the place. Now, of the animals that are sent in the United States, bats are the highest number of animals sent in to be tested for rabies. So then they're in general, the raw number is much higher. So that tends to kind of skew, I think, information. Because, I mean, who's going to catch a rabid raccoon in your backyard? You're just gonna run inside.
Sure.
But if you find a bat in your house, you know, you might, you know, you'd probably send that in to be tested. But about one in 250 bats test positive in the wild. So when researchers have been called in, and like, I have a friend of mine in Indiana, and he was called in years ago to a school, and there was bats living in the school, and one of them was out on the front lawn. And they tested it just in case, and it tested positive for rabies. So they went and collected all 300 of the rest of the bats in the school, and not a single other bat tested positive.
Wow. Wow. So that tells you that it's maybe not as prevalent. And I think the other thing is, when an animal gets rabies, it either dies or it starts to behave in a peculiar manner.
Correct.
And it becomes disoriented, and it's more likely to be found. So when you find a bat laying dead, it's probably got a higher probability of being rabid than a bat flying around eating mosquitoes acting like a bat. So since people have a predisposition to be afraid of them, when they find one acting erratically or dead, they, you know, naturally knee-jerk, it could be rabid. Well, I think that maybe because they fall out of the air when they die, you might be more likely to find one than a raccoon that's going to run off in the woods somewhere and lay down and die. I don't know. It just seems to me like they probably get a bad rap.
Yeah, and the other thing is, I mean, sometimes people find a bat on the ground because it's a young bat or a predator knocked it down. Or sometimes bats actually will go underneath leaf litter on cold nights to stay warm.
Sure, sure. I know when I was in Panama, we had a bar that we used to go to. It was on a third story of this building. And we probably got a bat in there at night. They must have been coming through the ducts or somewhere. And you pretty much have all these soldiers running around with cups. And somebody would eventually get one in a styrofoam. They're little bitty bats, and get them in a styrofoam cup and take them outside and let them go. So, I mean, my overall experience with bats is they're pretty friendly critters. Now, one of the things that anybody that gardens knows is that, and I don't know if this works out or not, it's kind of a hypothetical thing here, but if you're looking for good quality fertilizer, it's hard to do better than bat guano. So if I have a bat house in an area, those bats obviously at times are going to do what they do and drop manure to the ground. Can I basically grow, let's say, add nutrient to that particular area?
As far as I know, it's the highest nitrogen content of any animal dropping. So it's actually pretty expensive if you've ever tried to purchase it in small bags. It's pretty expensive. So you're right, though. The bat guano is a great fertilizer. You know, you use it pretty sparingly. What a lot of people do is they'll either put a trough, you know, underneath or a bucket or something like that and catch it. It also fills up with rainwater, and then it's a nice diluted, so then you can go ahead and use it in your garden. But it's great fertilizer.
Are there any disease concerns with that, or is that a pretty safe activity?
Completely non-toxic. Yeah.
Oh, okay, great. Right. Great. So I also want to talk, a lot of people are like, well, I don't think I have a lot of bats in my area. Now, I've lived in Texas, I live in Arkansas now, I lived in Pennsylvania, and I know there's bats in every one of those states. I've seen bats out in California, I've seen bats in the Northwest. So is there any part of America where if you put up a bat house, basically it's a decoration, you're not going to get any bats in, or are there pretty much bats throughout most of North America?
Yes, there's bats everywhere. Alaska's got 5 different species.
Wow, even Alaska?
Yeah. And there's plenty of species up, throughout Canada as well. The only state that you would not put up a bat house is Hawaii. There is a bat there. It's called the hoary bat, H-O-A-R-Y, and hoary means frosted. It's actually a really beautiful bat. It's got some dark color, but it's got some white and some yellow around its face. It's a solitary bat. It lives in live trees, so it would not use a bat house.
Okay, well, that makes perfect sense. So anywhere in America there are bats. There's just one state where there's no need for the houses. So let's talk a little bit about bat houses. What makes a good bat house? Can people build their own? Can they buy them from your organization? And when you have your bat house, kind of how do you want to set it up? Is there certain things you want to take into consideration with wind and sun angles and overhangs and protection from the elements?
Yeah, absolutely. And, we've been doing research on bat houses for a really long time. I started off at a university studying bats, and that was one of the first things I was really interested in. So what you want to do is you want to make sure the bat house is first of all, let's talk about placement. You want to put the bat house up at least 15 feet off the ground. The higher, the better. Face it towards an open, sunny location. So even in the south, we've got bat houses that are occupied in, Orlando, Florida, San Antonio, Texas. They're on a pole with getting full sunlight all day long, and they still get bats in them. So they do like really warm temperatures. It's better to put up more than one bat house. I usually put up, if I'm putting up a pole, I'll put up a bat house back to back. So you got one facing south and one facing north. Or one facing southeast and northwest. So then you've got a little bit of temperature difference between the two houses. On a pole or the side of a building work best. Tall, mature trees, or especially dead or dying trees, can work too. But a bat house that gets too much shade, the bats don't find it very well because they do use their eyes to find it, their eyesight. Also, it's too cool. So you do want to keep it in a facing an open, sunny location. So that's placement.
Okay.
The other thing is the design. A small bat house that looks like a birdhouse without a bottom, like a bluebird house without a bottom, is too small. What you generally want to have is at least 24 inches tall, 15 inches wide, and the openings at the bottom or the chambers on the inside about 3/4 inch. So, yeah, people can go on our website, batconservation.org, and then they can download plans on how to build their own bat house. We do sell bat houses, and they're made in Illinois by a family-owned company who uses northern white cedar. And so cedar or exterior-grade plywood, screws, you know, outdoor screws, caulking is also important because it's different than a birdhouse. A birdhouse, you want to make sure it's cool so that the baby birds don't bake. Well, a bat house, these are mammals, and we need to keep them warm. So that's why we want to keep it warm, dry, and safe from predators.
Very cool. I also, you know, I do a lot with gardening, and I talk a lot about gardening. And one of the big things I do from a gardening perspective is teach people that we want predators in the garden. Now, obviously, bats are a predator, but when I'm talking about that, I'm generally talking about the insect predators. I'm talking about assassin bugs and praying mantis and ladybugs and things like that. So one of the things that we'll do in our plantings is instead of trying to plant everything because I either like to look at it or I like to eat it, we also plant some things that are there for the predators. So we'll plant things like herbs with lots of flowers and stuff like that that'll bring in, predatory wasps and things like that. So if I want to really create a bat-friendly environment, I want these great predators in my area, are there things also that maybe I could plant to create more than just, because if I want to bring deer in, I'll probably want to create feed for them, and I'll want to create nesting areas. If I want to bring in squirrels, I want to create nesting areas and feed. It's not just about giving them a nesting area. I also want to give them everything they need in their environment. So are there things that I can plant that actually would attract bats, even though they're maybe not a vegetarian bat?
Yeah, absolutely. So it would be things, that would like a flower or something like that that would bloom at night or scent at night as well. So I know a lot of people will plant evening primrose, and that will bring in moths, that'll attract in moths, and then bats will then end up feeding on those moths. Some other things, goldenrod, phlox also. There's also non-natives, too, that you could plant, 4 o'clocks, moonflowers, and then aromatic herbs as well, which will bring in moths. But climbing vines is also a good idea, and because there are solitary bats, like red bats, that will hang in climbing vines.
Do you got any recommendations on, like, what type of a climbing vine would be good for? I mean, yeah, I do a lot with muscadine grapes on trellises and stuff like that. Is that good for them, or do they need something more substantial than that?
No, they're really not picky. So, actually just, something covering that they just kind of hang right behind. They're not attracted to, like, the smell or anything like that. They're just attracted to the fact that these vines are easy to, to land on and climb behind and, live in and stay protected. So that's really just what they're looking for is a protection. Spruce trees are great for hoary bats. They're found across North America. Same way with the red bats as well. So those are solitary.
So that's a species you mentioned in Hawaii.
Yeah.
So even though they have those in Hawaii, we have them here too.
Yep.
It's not a Hawaiian bat. Okay, very cool.
Yeah, it's really cool. Yeah, so they do. They're the only indigenous land mammals to the Hawaiian Islands. So no other land mammals should be on any of the Hawaiian Islands. Only the hoary bat, which is one of the largest bats in North America. It has about an 18-inch wingspan.
That's pretty big.
Yeah, so it's beautiful colors too. So those types of things in the garden, climbing vines, if people can leave up dead and dying trees, especially if they've got bark peeling. Obviously if they're going to fall on a building, you take them down. But snags are great for bats, also for woodpeckers and other you know, other types of animals. And like you said, I mean, really creating a healthy mixed ecosystem, you know, helps to decrease, you know, all these other insects that have really targeted a monoculture.
Oh, absolutely. And I think that's the, you know, it's about diversity, but it's not about diversity for diversity's sake. Just so you can say I have 50 species or 500 species of plants and animals and insects in my yard.
Yeah.
It's about interconnected diversity that all serves a purpose. And the way I put it is this way, people say, well, you know, all my stuff gets wiped out by insects. But you go out to a forest and you stand in the middle of a forest. And it's complete abundance, and no one sprays any insecticide,
right.
Nobody fertilizes anything, nobody turns any soil, nobody even freaking waters anything.
Right.
And to me, if we take one piece out, and we take something out, and it's small and insignificant, the whole thing can collapse on itself, and we start to have all these problems. But to me, something like a bat that people either have an irrational fear of or just don't care about is not a small piece of our ecosystem. If they're the number one insect predator, they're a massive piece of an interconnected ecosystem.
Yeah, and I think that that's something that so few people knew for so long. So I think that people assumed that they weren't good for anything and really went into caves and killed bats on purpose, killed tens of thousands of bats. You know, even in some of the wars, you know, bat guano was harvested for making gunpowder. And
yep. I can tell you when I was growing up as a kid in Pennsylvania, it was very common for people to go out with shotgun with like dust shot and stuff like that and shoot them
right.
when they saw them flying around, which was absolutely insane. But I think they were people that didn't know any better.
Correct. Yeah, and I lived right across from a farmer almost 20 years ago too, and he would go out and shoot the bats as they came out of his barn. And right after I moved in, and actually the neighbors or the people who sold us the house told me, you know, well, oh, you study bats? Well, you might want to educate our neighbor across the street. But you know, I went over and talked to him, and he's like, wow, I had no idea, you know. And after that, he actually a couple years later he ended up putting up some bat houses. So.
So that solves two problems. One, he has more bats, and he stops killing them. And two, they're less likely to be in his barn right. where he doesn't want them because they have a place to go.
That's right.
So let's talk about what happens. You know, I remember as a kid, we had these bats flying all around in Pennsylvania. And then as you went into fall, you'd see less bats. And then all of a sudden, you don't see any bats at all. So because you go into winter, and it's too cold, and the insects aren't out. So what happens to them? Do they hibernate, or do they go somewhere else? Do they migrate?
Both. So some species migrate, but not a lot. So they'll migrate to warmer temperatures. We don't really know for sure how far. It's difficult to track them long distances. We do know a little bit about how far they go. You know, they might go 500 miles. Some might go farther. Most bats want to travel as little as possible, obviously, to reduce the amount of energy it takes to get out of the cold. But they can't withstand the freezing temperatures for more than a few days. So most bats find either a cave, a mine, or even a building. Buildings that are heated, you know, large buildings especially. Sometimes the bats could find just the right temperature, right around 35 to 40 degrees Fahrenheit, to be able to hibernate through the winter. But by far, most bats will go to caves or mines. They'll go underground, where it's below freezing. No, it's above. It's above freezing.
Above freezing.
And then, yeah, and then they sleep through the winter. They're true hibernators, anywhere from about 3 months to about 6 months of true hibernation. Now, there's also a problem. I don't know, Jack, if you've heard about this white nose syndrome.
I've seen it on your site, but I'm really not familiar with it.
Yeah, it's pretty unfortunate. You know, you haven't gotten it out west yet, but in Arkansas, it's relatively close now. This fungus appeared about 5 years ago, and it appeared outside of Albany, New York. And just a caver and photographer took a few pictures of a couple of dead bats. And about 6 months later, had given the pictures to a wildlife biologist in New York, and he looked at it and he said, this is really strange. So he went out and collected some of them, had it tested, and found out they had this weird fungus on them. Well, we've never seen this fungus, but unfortunately it starts spreading. The next year they had more, the next year they had more. And what it is it's this fungus that we think was accidentally brought here from Europe. Because it does definitely look like it's a fungus that's been around for at least 20 or 30 years in Europe. And this fungus grows on bats during the winter. And it doesn't kill the bats, but what it does is it wakes them up. And so these bats are waking up about 4 to 7 times more often than bats that are not that don't have the fungus on them. And so since they wake up too many times, they end up starving to death. So it has spread in only 5 years from one state to 18 states, 4 provinces in Canada, and well over 1 million bats have died from it.
Wow, so we've got colony collapse going on with the bees, and now we've got this fungus starting to run rampant through the bat population. Well, a couple of questions there. One, kind of why I asked the question in the first place about migration is, I've noticed that bat houses will, you know, a lot of times empty out at the end of the season, right? So they go somewhere else to hibernate. Is there anything we can do to help provide hibernation habitat, or do they kind of look after themselves for that? And then this with this fungus that you brought up, is there anything that people can do to reduce the incidence of that? It doesn't really sound like there's anything we can do, but I want to ask.
Yeah, so the fungus does not affect humans or anybody else or any other animals, plants that we know of yet. So that's a good thing. It's only affecting bats. What people could do to help that out would be, you know, if they're visiting, one of the big things that we're doing is decontaminating. So if you visit, you know, if you visit a mine somewhere or a cave, and then you go and visit another one a week later or something, just make sure that your gear, your boots, your bag, whatever has been, you know, washed, wiped down with like Lysol wipes, something like that, that will.
So especially like people that are like spelunkers that are doing cave exploration, they love that environment. They need to, same way that like we have zebra mussel problems now, you have to clean your boat between different lakes, right?
That's exactly right. So there is a possibility that humans are spreading it. We also know that bats are spreading it, but let's reduce the amount of spread by, you know, just washing our gear in between, you know, places. So, but, you know, for bats during the summer, they're not going to be affected by the white nose syndromes, but one way to help them out is to put up bat houses, because bats that do have a hard time during the winter also often have a hard time during the summer because of so much habitat loss. So the bat houses are great for, you know, for all bats. They do leave the bat houses in cold climate, during the winter, and, some people have tried putting some warming strips, or even simple, you know, low wattage, light bulbs behind, you know, kind of as a side compartment in bat houses, and have been testing them to see if bats will stay in them. Some people have actually created, underground habitat for bats, that has also worked as well.
That would be ideal, because that's what they're actually looking for, because they get that constant temperature from, once you go to about 3 feet underground, it just doesn't freeze down there.
Right. So, I know some people that had like a big hole dug, and they put a culvert in and then filled it up, and, you know, with local biologist guidance, and, you know, hoping to, and some have, attracted bats to hibernate in them.
So it seems to me like it's a no-lose proposition, that if we attract bats, we have very low risk of any kind of real problems. In fact, we might mitigate our problems because we give them the habitat. They're not going to come into our homes. And they give a lot back to us in the nature of predator control. Can you maybe just extrapolate how much predator control we're really talking about? You said this one person had, what, 6,000 bats on their property?
No, he has about 6 different bat houses, and he's got well over 1,200 bats.
Okay, 1,200 bats. So 1,200 bats.
Yeah.
How much does one bat take out a night in the, you know, the high insect times of the year? And what happens when we multiply that by something like 1,200?
Exactly. So if you're looking, these are nursery colonies. So males roost usually typically by themselves or with another bat or two. These are primarily all females, so they're eating a half to their entire body weight in insects every single night. The smaller bats eat smaller insects, so they can eat more of them per night. So I would say, you know, a bat's eating an average of around, let's say, 3,000 insects a night. So 3,000 insects a night times these 1,200 bats is over 3 million insects a night.
That's a lot of crushing and spraying, folks.
A night.
I mean, you got it. I mean, you're talking a night, and then you go by, you know, depending on where you live, you have 90 days of summer or 180 days of summer time temperatures where these guys are heavily active in doing that. And you start to wonder why we even have the problems we do with insects. And most of our pest insects are flying insects. And what does that mean? They're bat fodder. And yet we have problems with mosquitoes. And I think that if we have problems with all different types of like you said, moths. And I mean, a moth is the slowest moving thing in the world, I think, compared to a bat. A bat is a moth is like bat candy. And we have these problems with coddling moths and these different fruit moths and things like that. And I think we would just have less problems if we had more bats. So if you guys think I was batty for bringing Rob on today, hopefully this is kind of converting you to the other side and understanding that it's very difficult as we're trying to do things organically and naturally and from a permaculture standpoint. If we take away such a critical component and don't allow it to do its job, because what else eats 3,000 insects a day? I don't know of anything. Everybody likes to have mice, you know, as long as they're not the black widow spiders around. Well, a spider might eat 1 to 2 insects a day, and where a bat can wipe out 3,000.
Yeah, they're the only mammals that we know of that's ever flown, and so to be able to fly as a mammal, they need to create a lot of energy, and that's why they eat so much. They have a very high metabolism, but they'll live a really long time. They'll live 20 or 30 years old, which is pretty unusual for an animal with that high metabolism, especially being...
And that small.
Yeah, exactly. But you're absolutely right. I mean, you know, rabies is very rare. Insect-borne diseases is more common, so you know, decreasing the chances of bats living in your house by putting up a bat house, but also decreasing the insect-borne diseases, but also especially moths and beetles. You know, there's some studies that recently come out, and one in particular showed what U.S. farmers benefit from bats, insect-eating bats, is annually. $26 billion worth of insect control.
$26 billion from a bat.
Yeah.
So, folks, that means start building some bat houses. And if people want to learn more and they want to do things like, I think they can get bat houses from you guys, but they can also get, like, plants and stuff. I mean, what kind of resources will people find at your website, which, again, is batconservation.org?
Yeah, we do have a lot of really good stuff on our website.
Mail.
So sorry.
It's all right.
Yes, we do have a lot of really good stuff at our website. We've got plans, detailed plans on how to build your own. We do have books also on building your own bat houses. So, you know, people want the hard plans, they can get those. But we do sell bat houses. We've got a variety of different sizes, and all the proceeds go back into our conservation work. But there's even, you know, how to take a bat walk. How do you find bats? Where do they live in your neighborhood? Gardening for bats. So there's a lot of other resources on our website as well.
Very, very cool. Well, hey, Rob, I appreciate you coming on the show today. And hopefully this gives folks kind of a different topic. I like to mix things up once in a while, and I think this is a great topic, and you guys are doing some great work there. How did you end up, did you found this group, or are you part of it and kind of recruited in? What's your stake, I guess, in the organization for bat conservation?
I'm the director, and I'm the co-founder of the organization. So I've been, you know, I started working with bats in 1992, and a fellow researcher and I kind of realized a big lack of information out there, and then we, you know, slowly kind of recruited other people to come along. So we've got 10 employees. We do educational programs. We're located here at Cranbrook Institute of Science, which is in Southeast Michigan, and it's a cool natural history museum where we teach people about bats, and we have a lot of rescued bats, so we care for live bats. And actually, if anybody lives in the Great Lakes region, we have the 10th annual Great Lakes Bat Festival, and people can come to the Bat Festival on July 9th here at the museum. And we've got experts from all over the Great Lakes teaching about bats. We have bat house workshops. It's kid-friendly as well. And then we also do research here, too. So even at night, we'll be checking out local bats, catching local bats at night.
You're going to catch them. You guys even do, like, live shows and stuff like that, right?
Yeah, I travel all over the country and do educational programs. So, people can actually go on our website and check out our calendar. But I travel from Boston to California to, you know, Minnesota down to Texas. So I do education programs with our live bats. So just similar to if somebody's ever seen a birds of prey program, you know, an owl program or something, I have live bats that we bring.
And if you go to Rob's website again, batconservation.org, what's on there right now is a picture of Rob sitting next to Conan holding up a really big bat. I'm not sure what kind of bat that is, but that's a big bat.
Yeah, so that was on the Tonight Show during his short run of that. But that's the biggest bat in the world. So that is a big fruit bat. So anything big with small ears, a dog-like face, looks like a fox, so we call them a flying fox. Those are fruit bats, and those live in Southeast Asia. We only have insect-eating bats, or at least almost entirely only insect-eating bats in the United States. We've got a few nectar feeders down around the Texas border, and we occasionally see a fruit eater off the Florida Keys, but we primarily just have all insect-eating bats around here, which are pretty small.
I'm glad you brought that up because I forgot to ask you that. I wanted to ask you about that because there are some that are fruit eaters, and the farmer, the permaculturist, the gardener may be concerned, well, if there's a bat that's eats fruits, will it come and eat my peaches or whatever? And we just don't have that issue in North America.
Right. There are no fruit-eating bats in the U.S. and Canada. And even in the wild, you know, they do primarily eat ripe fruit. So, you know, on a big tree, they're probably not causing a lot of financial damage, except in areas where there's a lot of rainforest that's been completely eliminated. Then, yeah, they do sometimes come into, fruiting farms and then kind of decimate it. But most places.
Gee, do you mean that if you destroy something's habitat and replace it with something else, that they'll do the best they can? That's shocking.
I know. Yeah, cut down the rainforest and then plant all bananas. I think they're going to come in and eat your bananas.
Because they don't have anything else to eat, and they might even learn to like a banana at that point.
Yeah, in the wild, they're actually pollinators of bananas. They're pollinators of agave. They're the only pollinators of agave. So without bats, we wouldn't have agave nectar or tequila.
That would be horrible. If I couldn't occasionally have a good old Jimmy Buffett recipe style margarita, I think I would have jumped off a cliff a long time ago. So, folks, you owe bats big time, man, because that's when I have a really tough day, that's one of my little solaces is either a beer or a margarita. I had no idea I owed the bat for agave.
Right.
So that's cool, too. And if people really want to help out, you guys even have, like, where they can donate and sponsor your organization?
That's right. Yeah, people can donate, become a member, or even help, like, sponsor one of our bats. So we have over 150 bats that we care for. We've got bats that are very old, cataracts, cancer. We treat them for allergies. So obviously we have a lot of costs. And these are bats that either people had illegally as pets or they lived in zoos or something like that. And it's really a rescue site that we can care for these bats in their last years. But they also make for great educational animals, too.
Yeah, I'm sure we learn from them, and then they help expand the knowledge base and make people, because I think there's a lot of people who have an unnatural fear,
yeah.
Or maybe it's even a natural fear because it's innate, but they're afraid of these things because they don't understand them, and the way you get rid of fear is through understanding. So thanks for coming on the show today and helping bring some of that understanding here. Again, folks, the website is batconservation.org, and I guess, do you guys have any way people can connect with you there? Are you guys on the social media bandwagon yet or anything with Twitter and Facebook and all that?
Oh, for sure, yeah. We've got a couple of Facebook pages. Our primary Facebook page, then we have a Bat Festival Facebook page. And we're doing Twitter slowly, and we do have a bunch of video up on YouTube as well.
Great. So, folks, get on by Rob's website. Connect with him if you're a social media type person, which, of course, I am, and I think everybody should be because that's a new way the world's communicating and help spread the message. And if you want to get rid of literally tons of insects a year without doing a whole lot of work. Maybe consider putting in a few bat houses, planting some things that will help help out with improving the overall bat habitat in your area. And above all, don't be afraid of them. Rob, you got any final thoughts for us today?
No, I think you're right. And I think the last thing is to tell other people. So, you know, the best way to protect something is to be educated about it and then tell lots of other people.
Well, Rob, again, thank you for being on the show today. And with that, this has been Jack Spierko with another edition of the Survival Podcast, helping you figure out how to live that better life if times get tough, or even if they don't. Well, thanks for tuning in to this episode of the Survival Podcast, Friday Flashbacks. If you enjoyed today's show, please consider becoming an MSB member. Just go to thesurvivalpodcast.com and click on members to learn more. You can also support our show by going to TSPAZ, that's T-S-P-A-Z, TSPAZ.com, anytime you shop online. And while you'll support us, no matter what you buy, you will find over 500 reviews of items I have personally tested and vouch for. And to stay in touch with us and never miss anything, follow our channel or our group on Telegram. You can find links to that and all our social media options. Just go to thesurvivalpodcast.com and check the show notes for any episode.